aquifers and watersheds. Understanding our water resources. A production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. Episode 8. Watersheds Past. Oaks, Rings, and Answers. Once more, we are back. In this episode, I would like, if I may, to take you on an unusual journey. I had been invited to accompany some researchers funded by the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute who are investigating the watersheds of Wisconsin from a chronological perspective using tree rings. I've always been interested in the scientific study of tree rings, or dendrochronology as it is known, so I dragged myself out of bed at an ungodly hour to make the long drive down to the UW campus in Platteville, where I'd arranged to meet the team at the trees lab. It seemed a fairly ordinary Saturday when I set out from Madison that dark February morning. It's true that the weather had been quite cold and blustery in the area toward which we would be driving. It's true also that we were meeting far too early for my taste, but I was not going to let that spoil the events of the morning. It was a morning we were going to remember for a very long time. Here we are at the University of Wisconsin, Platteville. I'm with some research scientists. We are going to go out and core some trees.
Yeah.
Could you guys identify yourselves?
I'm Marty Green.
I'm Sarah Allen.
Lane Johnson.
And you guys are all?
The trees lab.
Geographers? What's the correct answer? There's any number of answers.
Confused.
But yes, we are all with the trees lab.
One answer came immediately to my mind.
Sleepy.
That too.
I don't have much to say at 8:20 in the morning.
I know. Why do scientists have to get up so gosh darn early?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Do you have some answers for me?
You gotta talk to the person that runs logistics.
Who's that?
Sarah.
Yeah.
Why do we have to get up so early?
Why do we get up so early to do this stuff?
Oh.
It's all in the name of tree science.
I guess. Okay, do you have the...
I have the DBH. Do you have tape?
Some straws.
Yep.
Yeah, straws are in the car.
Wax.
So I think that's all we need.
Okay.
Excellent.
Here we go.
All right.
So off we went to the research site.
Sorry.
We were a little doubtful we were in the right
spot. Yeah.
Wait, straight down.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Looks like we went to the wrong house.
Yeah, it didn't look familiar.
Don't record that we went to the wrong house.
This is part of the research process.
Yes.
Probably get it back down. Or not. All right.
Let's go to the next house, farm, place.
It seemed that fortune had smiled and that they had found the assistance that their plight required. Or had they?
We're at the research site, and the road is absolute ice. Now, the lead car has gone down the ice road. But Marty and I didn't want to risk that, so we parked at the head of the road. The property owner just pulled up, and he was worried about the ice as well.
She made it down?
Not all the way, but they're trying to turn around and come out, so we'll see if they get out.
Well, why don't we go up to the upper farm, and you could park your car right up there. It's a good place to park.
Okay.
I'll empty this truck out so you can ride down with me. Safe with this. I got new tires, four-wheel drive. I parked right here when I came out so you couldn't go in. Uh-huh. And then I seen you come.
Been pulling the wrong spot. Yep.
You went to Harvey Cruz.
I really should interrupt our story to point out that the property owner that you're listening to, who's sounding more like John Wayne than anybody in Wisconsin really has a right to, is Dennis Use. We're in the far west of Wisconsin, somewhere outside of Dickeyville, not far from the Mississippi River. The temperature is in the single digits.
Get it in the trees lab. Do you want me to wait for Sarah? We'll
turn
right.
Wait a little bit here. I don't know. Maybe she'll get out.
And maybe she won't.
I got a feeling I'm going to have to be tractor and chain.
The perils of research in the Wisconsin winter.
I'm going to walk down a bit, see how they're doing.
Well, hey, I don't know if you even want to walk on it. I'll go up to the upper farm and then I'll come back.
Okay.
All right.
I'm going to follow her.
Yeah. Be careful.
The departure of their host left them feeling both apprehensive and uneasy.
It'll be a real rodeo today, Chris.
It was clear that this was to be no picnic.
At times doing fieldwork, interpersonal skills take on critical importance. After Dennis returned and we started down the valley in his truck, Marty rose admirably to the occasion. Her good spirits really kept her team on track.
We'll push it out. We'll all just be sled dogs. You've got trees down there you wanted to see, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just everybody. Yeah, I was just gonna
haul everybody down.
Well, Tommy doesn't have to worry about dinner. At least I got dinner covered for tonight.
You'll make it out of here
right.
Easy.
We'll see you in a bit. Yeah.
As it turned out, Dennis had much more than a passing interest in trees.
When did you get interested in the oak trees?
It was in my blood. You know, when you're a little kid in grade school, they ask you, who's your favorite person of America? A lot of them would pick Washington or Lincoln or Edison. Mine was John Chapman, Johnny Appleseed. Yeah, I remember the story of how he planted those trees all over and I don't know, it just stuck with me.
I've heard that the reason he planted so many apple trees is he liked to drink hard cider, so that's why he planted apple trees.
Well,
is there any truth to that?
Oh, I don't know, you know, and it's hard to tell. I'm not even sure how credible Mr. Chapman was, but it's in American folklore, obviously.
How many trees have you planted?
In my life? Well, most people wouldn't believe me, but we own 2 tree planters and planted some years 70,000-80,000 in a season, which is April, May. So there's just a small window of the year that you can plant trees successfully in the spring. And you know, it's really go when it's time to plant because you've only got that little window. 70,000-80,000 some years. 10 years of that would be 800,000.
So you've planted over 1 million trees?
I'd say somewhere close to that million mark. I plant every year. The ones you plant are quite small, only about a foot tall. The deer browse off some of them, the rabbits, and drought conditions. You're lucky to end up with half of them. But anyway, a lot of this has been established. I plan to plant probably till I can't dig anymore, but.
What do you hope to be the legacy of all this effort that you've dedicated your life to?
Well, I've driven by woodlots that are into maturity now, and people say, wow, it's beautiful, and then when they realize I was the one that planted them, it's hard to believe that it happens that fast. My thought is to do it now. Don't worry about, well, I'll never see that tree make maturity. Don't even worry about that. Just plant. When you get the feeling to do it, that's the time to do it, because every day you plant is another day gained for that tree. And they grow faster than you think.
Meanwhile, Sarah and Lane had managed to get their vehicle to the bottom of the valley, where there were some large white oaks ideal for the study. We got out of the truck and walked the last quarter mile through the snow to join them, while Dennis regaled us with tales of local history.
Shack there. Okay. And they had eight people, how they lived in that little bitty shack. In fact, Mrs. Creffley, in February of 1910, birthed the baby girl.
Wow.
In that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been there.
So the rest of the family probably wasn't in there at that time.
And then they built the house.
Big tree. Is this white? Until April 1st, but then I'll have all next year again.
Marty, could you tell our listeners what these researchers are doing? Describe it perhaps a little.
Sarah's measuring the circumference around the base of the trunk at breast height to find out how big the girth of the tree is. And Lane is using an increment bore to get what they call core out of the tree. So there's a bit on the end of that increment bore that's razor sharp, but it's got a small hole in it. And as they turn it in to the tree, it takes a little tiny, like a fourth of a centimeter pore there, and you can see him pulling it out. And that's what they'll use to mount and count tree rings. And they'll be able to see years when there was good wood production and it put on a lot of wood. Or they'll see years that are smaller years with less water or other conditions, maybe an insect infestation or something, where the growth rings are smaller. And then they'll start to look for patterns in that, for cycles of drought and things like that, and just look for the tree to tell its own story.
So you can get an idea of what was happening in the watershed and what's going on with all the water over time?
Yes, you can get some ideas about what's going on in the area. And the nice thing about tree rings is you're getting an annual time scale instead of thousands of years you're looking at each year. So what they will do is do some cross-dating with precipitation records and historical records and things in the area. The bark end of that core starts the year 2013, because that's the last time this tree put wood on. And then they will count each ring back to get how many years has this tree recorded of history.
Do you find variation between the different cores that you do, or are they generally pretty similar?
You know, I'm not certain about that. This is my first semester doing coring, but I know that tree ring databases are one of the largest scientific research bases that we have. We have ring information from 5 continents, and we have some dendrochronologists who have thousands of years of history from coring live trees, you know, some of the trees that live to be 3,000 years old or better, and they're actually able to core timbers of homes and use the pattern in the woods to continue cross-dating and going back in time. It's an amazing science that's giving us a perspective that we're better at wrapping our mind around. Hundreds of years and thousands of years instead of millions and billions. And you know, that's the beautiful thing, is that it's opening up that dialogue about what's really going on in our environment in a time scale that we're actually able to conceptualize. And hopefully that will help bring us more peace about how we're taking care of the blessings that we have.
By this time, I was starting to get chilled to the bone. But we had set a time and a place to get some tree cores, and it looked like we were going to persevere.
Fate, it seemed, had decided that they should keep that appointment in a situation which none of them could have possibly foreseen.
Here, I'm going to just start pulling this out, Sarah, if you want to hold on to it.
Thank you.
This cord looks like a dowel.
Yeah, it does kind of, doesn't it?
The bore that you hear is not particularly large. And Lane is just twisting it, letting the bit do the work.
It doesn't seem to come out much easier than it went in.
Oh, after
getting out the time
works. Sarah, the Water Resources Institute is helping sponsor some of this work, right?
Yeah, they're funding the grant that we're working on.
How does this all relate in with water resources?
Well, the oak trees we're looking for usually grow on drier sites, which makes them more sensitive to things like drought. Our oldest tree has been about 302 years old, and the instrumental records go back about 100 years. So
if we can
look at the record of trees along with the instrumental record and say, okay, these follow a similar pattern, then we can use the extra 200 years that goes beyond the instrumental records to then use the tree ring growth to look at cycles of drought earlier on than when people actually started recording precipitation and temperature and all that good
stuff. I got a John Deere tractor.
So you're getting a history of water.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, through the oak tree. Since everything that grows is affected by its climate and its surroundings. Yeah, oak trees are really good at doing that. They're very slow growers. Okay, hold on, I gotta.
How many trees are you actually sampling in this study?
About 300 is the number we're shooting to hit. So we've done about 150 this winter. So yeah, I'm hoping to core another like 150 next winter. But this winter was kind of a learning process for me, so I think it's going to go much smoother next winter.
I feel compelled at this point to suggest that since researchers and students are notoriously underpaid and overworked, the team should consider getting an extra hour's sleep so to arrive on site refreshed and ready. The trees really won't care if you get there at 9 or 10. And also, drink lots and lots of coffee. Coffee.
It's definitely been a learning process, but it's been really fun. It's been a great experience for me to have, from meeting landowners to working with students, working with other geographers who have a little more knowledge than I do on the subject. But yeah, it's been a great experience for me to have. So I've really enjoyed every aspect of it, from being able to be out here outside working all day to seeing every little nook and cranny of Southwest Wisconsin.
Do you see a lot of variation in the tree ring records from tree to tree?
Most of our sites have been pretty similar. Most of the oak that we've cored have been on ridge tops, usually south or southwest facing slopes. So they've been pretty similar. The patterns that I'm seeing are pretty similar. We do have one site, White Oaks State Natural Park, where the oaks grew up in a closed canopy setting, and the growth patterns do seem to look different. Now, we haven't actually got into the data analysis part, so I can't put that in numbers yet. But just looking at the actual cores, they do look different from some of the big open grown ones that we've gotten on these ridge tops. Maybe they're not as sensitive to the water resources, like either temperature or precipitation, because there's more competition in a closed canopy. So maybe they're responding to the other trees around them rather than available precipitation. I'm not sure yet what that's going to tell us, but I have noticed a difference. So it has been kind of interesting to see that.
Could you explain to our listeners what closed canopy is?
Yes. Closed canopy just means more of a filled-in forest where you're not getting gaps in the canopy. Everything is grown up into the canopy and filled in. So you're going to have a lot more competition between trees. The topography was different in that state natural area as well. It was pretty flat, where our other sites were all growing on slopes. The trees probably are going to respond differently in a setting like that compared to open grown, where you don't have any trees right around you. These trees are able to grow up and spread out, huge spreading canopies. And that's kind of the iconic oak tree. When you think of an oak tree, you think of these large spreading canopies, where in the forest setting, an oak will grow straight up. So you'll just have this really, really long trunk, and then the branches all come out at the top. So it's a much different looking oak than I think what most people think of when they think oak tree. You know, most people think of these large branches that you can climb and build a tree house and tire swing and all of that kind of stuff. So it's a much different setting.
So it's important to get a large sample.
Yeah, the project is going to cover 10 counties in the driftless area of Wisconsin. We're going to have a pretty good region that's going to be covered. Right now, I've had about 2 sites for every county so far. I'm gonna try to fill in the gaps next winter. I know along where the Wisconsin comes over and meets the Mississippi, right along that strip, we have some missing spots just because it seems like that area was logged really heavily. Even just driving around and scouting in that area, I haven't seen a lot in the way of really big old oaks.
He's freezing. Why don't we go up there and warm that up and you can talk to him in a lot warmer.
Okay, hold on, I just gotta get this labeled.
So it all came out well in the end. We got our samples. By using some Minnesota grit, Lane was able to get their car out of the valley without needing to be towed, and I was able to get home without a case of frostbite. This study of trees is important work. By learning about watersheds in the past, researchers like the Trees Lab can help natural resource managers make more informed decisions about watersheds for the future. If you'd like to help and think you may have an old oak that they would like to sample, then send an email to trees@uwplatt.edu.
I'm sure they'd like to hear from you. And this brings us to the end of our series. I hope you learned some things about aquifers and watersheds, along with picking up a few new Scrabble words. By the way, for a three-letter word, oak actually has a pretty good score. Okay, well, that's it. This is Chris Bocast, and this is the last time. I'm moving on to other pastures, but before I go, I have to give a shout out to everyone at Sea Grant, and especially Moira Harrington for being the best boss anyone ever had anywhere. And thank you too for listening. May you all have fair winds and a following sea. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute.